is case number 72067, Dwayne Harden versus State. Mr. Waters for the appellant, and Mr. Sweeten for the respondent. Mr. Waters.
May it please the court, my name is William Waters. I'm with the Clark County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Harden on appeal. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm sorry, how many minutes?
Three.
I'll take a look at the clock for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So Mr. Harden was convicted at jury trial, serving a lengthy, essentially a life sentence in prison after conviction, and there are a number of errors that occurred at trial which both individually and collectively violated Mr. Harden's due process right to a fair trial. I'd like to start with the Miranda issue because I think that that impacts one of the other important issues in this case, which is the state's reliance on the voluntary intoxication instruction, which probably wouldn't have happened, well, would not have happened, had the judge correctly suppressed the Mr. Harden's statement to police. So Ms. Rodosta, prior to trial, she filed her motion to suppress, attached a copy of the transcript of the interrogation, and additionally, Judge Villani actually watched the interrogation video. It was a pretty clear-cut issue in Ms. Rodosta's mind, which was Detective Fortunato went line by line asking Mr. Harden, you know, you have the right to an attorney. Do you understand this right? And Mr. Harden replied, yes. Now, when we get to the very end of this, and by the way, personally, I think Fortunato did the right thing with how he administered the Miranda warnings. I actually think that's preferable to just kind of reading them all and then waiting till the end and saying, hey, do you understand all those rights? Because this gives a very clear indication of whether there was any ambiguity in whether he understood them or not. But when we get to the very end, Fortunato asks him a single question, which is, understanding all your rights, do you wish to talk to us? And I don't know how more unequivocal Mr. Harden could have been other than to say, hell no. He said no. And then Detective Fortunato, instead of scrupulously honoring that invocation, asked four questions. No. What do you mean? You don't want to talk to us? Do you want a lawyer? What's the deal? That violates United States Supreme Court precedent, Ninth Circuit precedent, in fact, even this own court precedent in Dewey versus State. So at the hearing, the state argued, well, you can look at, well, first the state kind of conflated voluntariness with invocation, which is, I think, what they also, Mr. Van Bostrick did on appeal in writing the brief. He spent an inordinate amount of time discussing whether Mr. Harden voluntarily waived his Miranda warnings, and we're not, the U.S. Supreme Court, Smith versus Illinois, says, hold on, those are two separate things, let's keep them separate. So we're talking about, did he invoke his right to remain silent? Voluntariness is not an issue here. So the sole issue that the district court should have looked at was whether this was an objectively unambiguous invocation. And all indications are that it is. You know, when Mr. Harden said, when Fortunato asked him, do you understand you have the right to an attorney? And Harden said yes. There wasn't this like, well, what do you mean by yes? You know, that doesn't make any sense. Like, can we talk about this? So clearly he understood what yes and no means. And again, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, you don't have, there's no necessary words that are said which would trigger an invocation, but it's got to be at least objectively clear that you're saying, I don't want to talk. And I don't know how in the world anyone could credibly argue that this was not clear as day. He said the word no. There was no indication in the record that this was somehow, he said he mumbled this under his breath, or it was garbled, or that there was some ambiguity in whether that was really part of the record. I mean, all parties agree that the sum total of what he said in response to this question was no. So I think Judge Villani clearly, and by the way, your honors review this decision of Judge Villani's de novo, so we don't even really have to rely on what he found in the district court. But just for the purpose of being complete here, you know, what he essentially said was, we kind of adopted the state's logic, which was, well, you know, Mr. Harden was being so cooperative. He was such a nice guy. He was answering the police officer's questions. So when they finally get to the point where, you know, do you want to talk to us? It just kind of blew their minds that he would say no. Like, that didn't make any sense to them because it was just so, such a drastically different posture than he had up until then. Again, completely immaterial. As you noted in the briefs, the cases that the state relies upon are primarily pre-Davis, and the few that are post-Davis and between Davis and Berghaus, which is 1994 and 2010, are either no longer good law, have been vacated, or so forth. So the Ninth Circuit cases, which I provided, I think are on all fours on this issue, that statement should have been suppressed. Now, the state does have the obligation now, because this error is subject to constitutional harmless error review. So, you know, my position would be that that's obviously the state's obligation now to show that introducing the statement at trial, there was beyond a reasonable doubt it did not impact the verdict.
Well, why do you think it was harmless error? Or do you think it was not harmless error? I mean, looking at with the statement, it wasn't an inculpatory statement. Why do you believe it would not be harmless error?
Okay. You're right. Mr. Harden never actually said, I molested JJ, or I did these things that you're accusing me of. He did not say that. But the Fifth Amendment protects against any statements you make. They can't be used against you. And he did make a number of statements to the police. And what happened was the state wasn't able to use those statements in two ways. Number one, to get a voluntary intoxication jury instruction, which then, during closing argument, said, well, this is a defense theory, even though Mr. Gosta had flatly rejected that notion and said that's not our theory. So they basically foisted a defense theory upon the defendant based on what he had said during that interrogation. Number two, Fortunato repeatedly mentioned during cross-examination just how ridiculous Mr. Harden's statements were. Well, he said he was intoxicated. First of all, he never said he was intoxicated during the interrogation. He said he had some stuff to drink.
Didn't he tell them that before the interrogation, though?
One statement to Officer King at the house, which, by the way, was approximately 4 hours before the interrogation with Fortunato. So to the extent that there was any intoxication, you know, Fortunato's testimony that, like, well, I thought that was ridiculous because, you know, I'm a cop and I noticed he wasn't intoxicated. Well, gee whiz, that's 4 hours later. So clearly that doesn't matter. And if you look at the way the state used his statement in closing argument, it's the same thing. And Fortunato, by the way, also testified, well, you know, that the answers were vague. I wasn't getting straight answers, so I had to change my interrogation tactics to try to get him to say something. At one point commented on his silence and said, well, you know, most of the time just kind of sat there in silence, which I think is an implication that, like, guilty people don't talk. So they were basically able to use this. And again, the Fifth Amendment protects statements from being used against you. It doesn't necessarily just cover confessions. It covers any statements that can be used against you, and that's clearly what happened here. So when you have the over-reliance on the part of the state with respect to what he said, and through Fortunato's testimony, through closing argument, through the voluntary intoxication jury instruction, which essentially made it seem like the defendant was hedging his bets. I didn't do it, but if I did, you know, because it's labeled as a defense, I mean,
so
obviously it would only...
That's where you see the harm.
Well, that's where I think that there's a reasonable possibility that it affected the verdict, which I think is the standard for constitutional harmless error.
Also be an argument, first of all, voluntary intoxication can be a defense to specific intent crimes, right?
Right.
Okay, so why wouldn't it just as easily inure to his benefit in this case?
Well, I think that the defendant has the sole choice to decide how he wants to defend against the allegations.
Yes, but we're looking at harmless error.
Okay, well, so here's why. I think, and Mr. Dosta sort of pointed this out at trial. He's saying it didn't happen, it didn't happen, it didn't happen, it didn't happen, it didn't happen. She then has to address the voluntary intoxication aspect of it during her closing argument. I think most defense attorneys would say, well, I can't just kind of leave that hanging out there and let the state sort of, like, keep hammering on that. I have to at least address it. And I think, you know, there's jury instructions that say use your common sense. And I think the problem is it just seems so incongruous if you're saying it didn't happen, but then you're addressing it. It almost seems like a cop-out or you're trying to split the baby. And I just think that Mr. Harden is absolutely 100% entitled to choose the theory of defense that he wants. And I don't think the state or the court should be allowed to foist a defense upon him. And remember, the state did argue repeatedly and included it in a slide on their PowerPoint that this was a defense theory when it clearly wasn't. Ms. Rodasta objected at the time the during the settling of jury instructions. She objected when the state made this argument during closing arguments. She perfected that objection during a break in the proceedings. So I think it's harmful in the sense that jurors could get the idea that this guy is using alcohol maybe as an excuse, but he doesn't want to come out and say it. I mean,
let me ask you this, too, and this goes to Justice Stiglitz's question. My understanding, from what I recall, is right after the officers arrived on the scene and started their investigation, almost the first thing out of his mouth was that he was drinking.
He said I had some, I believe the testimony was, and you're correct, Your Honor, Officer King was the one who spoke to Mr. Harden, and then Officer Abbott was the one who spoke to Mr. Harden's, I'll call her his wife, although they were not legally married, just for and JJ. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Harden said, they basically confronted him with the allegations, and
right.
He said, well, I was drinking tonight, I don't know why they're saying I did this.
Now, let me ask you this. Officer King indicated who this was stated to.
Mm-hmm.
Did he testify?
I'm not 100% sure because I didn't do the trial, but I believe he did, and I think Mr.
Sweet
could probably address that.
Did he testify as to that aspect?
You know what, King did testify, and I do think that he actually did bring that up.
Okay, well then where's the error in going back to the Miranda statement?
But again, though, so he said, I'm intoxicated, 4 hours earlier than his statement with Fortunato, which is what the state primarily relied upon during closing argument. It wasn't King's statement.
But it would have come in either way.
But so here's the thing, that he didn't say, I did this to my daughter, but I was intoxicated when I did it.
He didn't say that in his statement that was admitted. There was a Miranda violation.
Well, right. So if he didn't say it in either statement, then why is the voluntary intoxication instruction even remotely relevant? Because he's not saying it negated my specific intent.
Okay. I think I understand.
Yeah, he's saying, the way Ms. Rodasta tried to explain his statement to King and Fortunato was, to the extent that he couldn't provide, you know, coherent explanations as to why he was being falsely accused of this, it may have been because he had been drinking earlier in the evening, but there was never a concession that he had done it or that he might have done it and just didn't remember because he was drunk. That came from the state, where they explicitly argued, well, maybe he didn't remember it because he was intoxicated. So that, Your Honor, is why I don't believe. Well, that's why I think that, you know, the reliance on that statement, the getting the instruction, is why there's a reasonable possibility that it affected the jury verdict, which I believe is the standard under constitutional harmless error.
You have about 2.5 minutes
left. Okay. I'm going to try to save that unless there's any questions. Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sweden.
May it please the court, James Sweden, on behalf of the respondent. I wanted to get into the implication here. To support the appellant's claim, essentially the defendant appears to be claiming that the mere word or phrase in response to Miranda controlled any of the surrounding circumstances. And that's essentially their argument, which might put the words or phrases into context, ultimately, if you were to look at the surrounding circumstances, might indicate to the police that the defendant's response might be ambiguous or equivocal due to the defendant's misunderstanding of the warning, the direct questions being asked by the police officers, or of the emotion, essentially, at the time. The state submits that if this were the law, it would be an unreasonable extension of Miranda and would lead to absurd results. The state would submit that requiring cessation of an interview when the questioning officers do not reasonably know whether the suspect is or is not willing
well,
to speak
you know,
with the
let
police.
Let me just stop you there.
Okay.
And I've read the transcript, and I don't know why they do this. Why do they push it? And this, to me, is striking. And there's a question. Okay, you don't want to talk to us. No. No, so you just want to remain silent? Do you want an attorney? What's the deal? I don't know. I guess I'm being arrested here. Well, that would be obvious given the situation, correct? Yeah. And then he goes on. Instead of stopping there, he goes on and pushes it. I mean, we'd like to give you an opportunity to talk to us if you want to, but you're entitled not to either. completely up to you. I can't give you legal advice. And then he goes on. So now you say you don't want to talk to us. You want to answer any of our questions. To me, you know, they know better than that.
Can I respond to that, Justice?
Yes.
Justice Perry, in this particular case, I would ask the court to look what happens before and after that statement. And I would note that both Medina would
decide. Wouldn't that send up a red flag if it were you in that situation? There would be red flags all over.
Well,
I could soil my entire investigation here. And having that statement admitted, I don't know why it was admitted in the first place. It didn't do much for you.
Well, Justice Perry, I guess. I'm getting to the reason why it would not be admitted, because in this case, I believe the law is clear that you can look to the facts and circumstances before and after the actual statement comes in. And I think that Medina and Williams both make that clear. And we're not saying that we look at the situation such that if you start talking to the suspect and the suspect starts answering your questions, that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about afterwards is a situation where, in essence, there is a clarification that's done, and you can see from the clarification that the individual actually was mistaken in regards to their response. And that's normally shown by a very quick response and essentially saying, okay, I'll answer your questions, that's fine. And that's what I'm saying. You know, if you get to the cases that were cited by the state in regards to Medina, I mean, that was a situation that was very similar to this case. And in that case, what happens is that the defendant is a suspect in a murder. A body is found stabbed. He's got the car. He's sleeping in the car. And he comes to the police, and the police talk to him. And as they talk to him, off the record, he's very cooperative. He's doing, you know, essentially appears to be wanting to talk to them. And then subsequently they say, okay, we're going to put this on tape. They put it on tape, and as they put it on tape, they give him his Miranda. They walk through, and they say, do you understand this? Yes. And he says, do you want to talk to us? No. And then subsequent to that, the police come back and says, no, what do you mean? And then ultimately, similar to this case, he comes back and essentially says, oh, well, it's sort of a misunderstanding. You know, I'm going to speak to you. Well, that's very similar to this case.
Mr. Stern, yes. If we decide that it's not, why isn't it harmless error in any event?
So the state would submit that it would be harmless error if it was. I mean, in this case, the appellant's contention that it's not is flawed. He basically says that similar to Garcia, that this case lacks corroborating evidence to support the victim's allegation. That's not the case here. In regards to the corroborating evidence, in Garcia, the defendant confessed in a 3.5-hour statement, and the only real evidence that the state had was the victim's testimony and his confession. There was no circumstantial evidence, no physical evidence, no corroborating evidence. That clearly is not the case here, the state would submit. Appellant did not confess in this case, unlike Garcia, as Justice Perry has indicated. In the statement that he gives about 31 minutes long, there's really not much that's inculpatory or really anything. The statement consists of a number of denials. The appellant appears to contend that evidence that he immediately noted to the police that he was intoxicated that night came solely from that statement. I think it's been ferreted out here. That's not the case. Because when the police make initial contact with him at the residence, he immediately tells them, he talks to them, and makes these sort of unsolicited statements. As the police say, hey, what's the problem here? He immediately says, well, he had been drinking that night. He had a Jack and Coke. He was intoxicated. He says some other things, that he was in this bedroom that night, in his daughter's bedroom, in this dark bedroom, basically talking about the iPad. He also talks about the fact that he's been accused of touching his daughter. The evidence presented at trial really went far beyond that in regards to the character of the evidence, because we had a situation here where the defendant essentially in the middle of the night was thought to be sleeping somewhere. The wife goes and tries to find him, can't find him anywhere in the house, walks through the house looking for him for several minutes, ends up coming to his daughter's bedroom. The testimony was that the bedroom door was closed, it was locked, it was clear that it was dark inside. The testimony came out that it was pitch dark inside. She begins knocking on that door. She hears something inside, but there's still no response. She begins pounding on that door. And ultimately, she walks across in a small house to a bathroom across the hallway, gets a bobby pin, is able to pick the lock of that door, and as she pushes it open, it's the appellant who's on the other side pushing back. Later we find out that behind the appellant is the victim in this case, and she's crying back there. It's a dark room. There's no ambient light. And ultimately, the victim is brought out of place, out of the room. She's crying. The defendant later indicates that he was in the dark bedroom with his daughter at that time talking about an iPad. He does that through yelling between himself and his wife as the patrol officers are there and they respond to the house. He also does it in a statement to Detective Fortunato. And along with that explanation being very suspicious under the circumstances, there was no iPod in the room, and that was brought out at trial. The victim in the case was frantic. Testimony was clear on that as she comes out of the room. Basically, that was testified to by her mother, her brother, the patrol officers, and the sexual assault nurse examiner, although testimony was elicited that she was normally very even-keeled. Girl didn't get very excited about anything. She made a clear disclosure of the sexual abuse at that time. Her mother sees and hears all of this. She gets on the phone. She's on the phone with 911. While she's on the phone, the defendant is attempting to prevent her from calling the police. He's begging her not to call the police, saying that they will send him to jail. All that's captured in the 911 call. The victim is also heard on the 911 call describing in that present state that appellant put his penis between her legs. All this 911 call was played in the course of the trial. The victim later gives a clear statement to the police of the abuse, not only that night, but on prior occasions. And as she's taken in for a sexual assault exam, she again gives that disclosure. And there is samples taken from her body, including a sample from between her legs. That sample was subsequently compared to the defendant's DNA and was found to match with a likelihood of 27,300 times. Now, the testimony at trial was specifically that a matched likelihood of 10,000 or more was very strong evidence. And testimony, which was unrefuted, defense did not present an expert, was that level of matchup couldn't have come from just casual contact around the house. That was something that was not consistent with that, but it was consistent with the conduct that was described by the victim. So the state would submit that the evidence in the case was very strong. Appellant's statement was a very small part of that, where he makes these exculpatory statements. He reiterates the statements already collected at the residence that came from officers. He appears to contend also that the jury did not believe the victim. And I would note that he cites a number of counts that were dismissed in the course of this trial. But I would note that my memory of this case is essentially that the victim testified very specifically to certain instances that happened. Besides that night, there was a few other instances she testified to. There were a number of instances she didn't specifically testify to, although she said that they happened on regular interviews. Those were charged. The jury came back with a verdict of guilty on all those incidents which she specifically described, with the exception of the cunnilingus count. And the difference in the cunnilingus count is she did not disclose the cunnilingus count to the police initially. She did not disclose that until her preliminary hearing testimony.
But can you do something for me? And sure. We know all this stuff. We read everything, okay. So we're pretty familiar with all the facts surrounding this incident. But we're being urged to re-examine Gasciola as it pertains to no corroboration instructions, and that it's impermissibly bolsters a victim's testimony. Can you address that just briefly?
Well, in Gasciola, this court recognized that the instructions does not unduly focus the jury's attention on any particular witness. Essentially, the instruction states the current law. In subject case, jury instruction number 20 was given and puts the testimony of any witness in perspective, specifically detailing what essentially the jury should do in regards to the credibility and believability of any witness. Thus, the no corroboration instructions does not improperly highlight the testimony of one witness over all the other witnesses.
Didn't it talk about the testimony of a victim of sex assault? I mean, it did pick out a witness. It didn't just say no witnesses, unless we have a conspiracy case, unless you're otherwise instructed, no witness requires corroboration if you believe them. But this actually does highlight the victim's testimony.
It does, but right. It's put in context with the witness instruction. But I would note that back when Gasciola was decided, the court specifically recognized that sexual assault cases are different. In those cases, many times the victim's testimony is the only testimony there. And they said specifically, quote, although the historical imbalance between victim and accused in sexual assault prosecutions has been partially redressed in recent years, there remains a continuing vitality in instructing juries that there is no legal requirement of corroboration. The court went on to indicate that all the instructions together strike a balance that protects the rights of both the defendant and the complaining witness. The state submits that that balance was struck in this case, and it's appropriate in cases of sexual assault to provide that instruction. When I was talking about the invocation in this case, the state's position would be that similar to the Medina case, that in this case there were surrounding circumstances surrounding that which gave the detectives just cause, or essentially an objective, reasonable reason to inquire further. Now, we talked specifically in regards to the issue in regards to, it was sort of a surprise. There was cooperation going on with the suspect. When he says no, it's a big surprise. But beyond that, the state would note that there was an ambiguity here that was put out, because as we went through and the detective gave the rights, the Miranda rights, to this particular suspect, he laid out through all those rights, went through them, he answered yes, that he understood each of those rights, and then at the conclusion, he asked him, essentially, do you want to talk to us? And he said no. So his clarification there, what he didn't see was he invoking his right to be silent, or was he invoking his right to have an attorney present? State would submit that that's an ambiguity here, and if you look at the question that's asked, it gets directly to that. So you just want to, he says no, so you just want to remain silent, you want an attorney, what's the deal? You know, in quick order after this, the defendant essentially basically lays out, says, yeah, he agrees to talk, and he goes forward, and he discusses the case with the detective.
Mr. Shulman, can I ask you a separate question, because I see you're running out of time, so I just had a question.
Sure.
And maybe it's just a philosophical question. In Crawford, we said that inverse instructions are proper, you should be given. By definition, an inverse instruction is always going to have been covered by other instructions, otherwise it's not an inverse instruction.
Yeah.
How do we address, because they never give them, and then we always say, well, it doesn't matter because it's covered by other instructions. Like, does Crawford have any teeth or relevance? Or should we just be honest and say, you're not going to get your inverse instruction, until we have jury instructions? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, I think that the problem with the inverse instructions is that I have not ever seen a case where inverse instructions are given that it's not completely confusing. And I've talked to juries after cases in which I've given those instructions, and they've agreed it's completely confusing. I think the much better road would be to give jury instructions that are completely in the middle and don't go either way.
Okay, that's fair.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Sweet.
Thank you.
Orders, you have 2 minutes and 17 seconds.
I don't want to necessarily belabor the point too much longer with respect to whether he invoked or not unambiguously. I think the court's sort of telegraphing the way it feels about that. I put in my reply brief the text from the Medina. If you read it, it's pretty clear why that was ambiguous. I mean, the guy was literally out of it. He was looking down. Half of it was inaudible. Williams, which he mentioned, they talked about the immediate context, and if you look at that, the defendant did have two questions pending, so it was a little unclear. That's vastly different than what we have here. I want to talk about the no corroboration instruction, and I think Your Honor, Justice Stiglitz, made an excellent point. So if a police officer testifies, if you believe his testimony beyond a reasonable doubt, isn't that enough to convict? Like, why do we make a distinction? Any witness who testifies, if you believe their testimony beyond a reasonable doubt, is probably sufficient to convict. But for some reason, we single out sex assault victims. And I suspect the reason is because this was a reaction to the Lord Hale instruction, which I would suspect most people say that was a terrible instruction, and we're glad it's gone, which was the instruction that you had to have corroboration in a rape case. We've moved on. This is not the 1950s, okay? We know now that that's a silly concept. But to remedy that, I think we started this court, which, by the way, Gatsoulas 13 years ago, believe it or not. And I know that seems weird, but 2005. So there might have been a time for this instruction when there were remnants of people out there believing that corroboration was required because women lie about rape. But I don't think in 2018 that's necessary anymore.
Well, let me ask you this. The whole policy behind that was that these cases are very difficult because most of the time you just have one witness. That was what the focus of Gashio was.
Most of the time.
Aspect.
You're correct, most of the time, but not always. I mean, again, in the years since, DNA evidence has developed, forensics has gotten better. So there was a time, Your Honor, where I would concede that this was probably a necessary instruction.
Well, DNA was pretty significant back in 2005 as well.
Right. And I'm just, Gaxiola was in 2005 when this court first and only addressed it. May I finish this?
Please.
Thank you. When this court addressed it, but this idea of removing the Lord Hale instruction went back way beyond that.
Right.
So I think if you look at the national trend, which I pointed out in my brief, there is a real concern about that instruction. I think Gaxiola misrelied on Gamage and Smith, and I think if you look at what's going on in this country, there's no reason for this instruction. It's not necessary. It's just not necessary in cases anymore. So I would ask this court to strongly consider maybe the propriety of that in future prosecutions, and especially in respect to what happened in Mr. Harden's case. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sweden. Good seeing you again. Mr. Waters, good seeing you again. You guys did a good job on this case. I think that the presentation was excellent and that the briefs were good. And this